Can you remind me, what's the phrase we came up with?
The military history and activism in the age of Trump.
Let's get this thing started.
Sure.
Welcome to Over There, a podcast about military history and activism in the age of Trump. My name is Terry Brennan.
My name is Matt Martin. I am a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, retired after 22 years. I spent most of my time flying unmanned aircraft, Predators and Reapers, but I also flew the RC-135 and spent a lot of time in various headquarters. And I'm a student of the military history and activism.
And I'm an actor and a circus teacher and a guy with lots and lots of opinions. and I would say I'm a student of activism. I don't know as much about military history, but I am a student of activism, and I'm always looking at what's happening, and I'm always looking at what might be effective to sort of like get points across, specifically in the realms of like equal rights, civil rights, equality for all, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about why we started this podcast. I sent you an email.
That's right.
I said, Matt, I'm sort of concerned about the direction of the country, but I was specifically concerned about some tweets Donald Trump sent out about expanding the nuclear capabilities of the United States military. And I asked you, what should I do to prepare to get out of town if I was worried that Philadelphia, the city where I live, was going to suddenly blow up?
Yeah.
And you kind of had an answer for me, which was a little bit, which took me a little bit by surprise.
This is, of course, something to be concerned about, right? It's been a long time since the potential leader of the soon to be leader of the free world was actively talking about expanding the nuclear arsenal, right? We haven't had that kind of talk since the 80s. Even, you know, as the Cold War was winding down, we still had lots of nuclear weapons on alert. George H. Bush and then Bill Clinton were mostly focused on reducing the nuclear arsenal while maintaining a credible deterrent. All of a sudden, this new talk about, hey, what can we, you know, we're going to massively increase our nuclear capability. And you know, I think Trump's words were, we will outmatch you and outlast you. That's something scary to think about. And all of a sudden we're kind of back in this Cold War mindset of, well, what would we do if there's a nuclear war? And of course, we almost had nuclear war on many occasions, between 1945 and 1991, where we started to sort of step back from the precipice, as we say. So your question is a legitimate one, right? And if things were to get out of hand, what would you do? The short answer is that's not the thing that you need to be worried about. The idea of this, it used to be called the bolt from the blue, a sudden, unanticipated, all-out nuclear war where major cities are burned to the ground is still a very, 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 very unlikely scenario. I think, as we're going to discuss, a much better approach would be to think in terms of, well, how can we, you know, prevent ourselves from ever getting to that point again? And then how can we shore up our civic institutions so that if something were to happen, maybe not an all-out nuclear war, but some sort of lesser catastrophe, how can we make sure that we as a society are prepared for it?
One of the things you told me was that, which I found a little bit reassuring. There's parts of it that were reassuring, and there are parts of it that I was like, I'm reassured for humanity, but I'm not reassured. I'm not sure if I'm reassured for my physical body. Yeah. Which was that, you know, the one thing you told me is that the world, as we know it so far, has not ended yet. And there's been many times when people have been like, the world's going to end. And legitimate claims, not just I'm a religious leader, I say the world's going to end, but people were like, this war will actually end civilization. And you were saying that in, what was it, 13,000 years was the...
13,000 years of human civilization, right? That's the first permanent human settlements that we have archaeological evidence of, or about 13,000 years ago in the Mideast area. And ever since then, and all that time, the world has never ended, right? There have been pockets of instability. There have been places where the social order has, even at times, completely broken down. You know, Germany at the end of World War II. So South Sudan is kind of getting close to that right now. Certainly Syria and North Iraq right now would count as areas that are completely unstable. But those are isolated areas, right? And even in a place like Stalingrad, in 1944, civilization had a way of reasserting itself. And it really didn't take long, you know, once the conflict was over, for civilization to come sort of roaring back in, right? So the idea, and it's kind of a popular idea, and you know, there are these people called preppers who spend all of their extra time and energy and money preparing for the end of the world. But this idea that civilization will suddenly collapse, whether because of a nuclear war or some sort of economic meltdown or just a general Rome is burning breakdown of the social order, it's never really happened, right? So civilization has a pretty good track record, and I don't think that's the thing that we need to be particularly concerned about. There's a lot of things we need to be concerned about, but the world suddenly ending is not one of them.
There are a lot of people that I knew growing up, and a few people I met as an adult, who were what you called preppers. They're really obsessed with the idea that pretty soon society as we know is going to fall apart. It's going to be every man for himself. Everybody's going to be like, it's going to be like Walking Dead, and you're going to be like wandering around in packs of people, and some people are going to be trustworthy and others aren't, and it's going to be chaos. Even if that was true, I don't know if I'd really want to survive. I would be worried about, like, well, if that's the case, if that's what I'm moving to, maybe I don't want to survive the attack. But the issue is one of the other issues that hit me is, short of like society shutting down entirely, is, so do I need to, say, prepare for, like, I need to leave the city I live in, because it's a big old city and it's a target, for 48, 72, 96 hours.
Yeah.
Like, is that something I need to prep for? Or is it like something, like, I know that people post 9/11, I know people had like bags to be like, well, I might have to leave New York for a couple of days. If another big thing happens, I might need to get out of town. Or is that another thing that I sort of like just need to, you know, is my time better spent doing something else?
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, maybe a little bit of background would help. You know, so there was a time when we were legitimately concerned about these things, right? In the late 70s, early 80s, the United States had 30 to 40,000 nuclear weapons pointed at the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union had 30 to 40,000 nuclear weapons pointed at us. They were maintaining a state of high readiness, and they were structured to actually fight a nuclear war, right? And this is the thing that is important to keep in mind. Not since the late 50s has the United States, or the Russians for that matter, had this idea that, you know, if nuclear war breaks out, we're just going to start blowing up cities because that's, you know, we want to really make sure that the nuclear war is going to be as terrible as possible, which was sort of the idea in the 50s, right? We had this idea called massive retaliation. And the idea was that, you know, if the Russians wanted to capture Western Europe and they want us to start rolling tanks through the Fulda Gap in Germany and invade Western Europe, the United States and the European allies did not have enough forces stationed in Europe at a state of readiness to stop them. And so the idea in the 50s was that, well, if they invaded Europe, we would retaliate with nuclear weapons, and it would be a massive retaliation, and it would be so terrible that the Russians would just not ever attempt that invasion because they know the outcome would be so awful, right? But that structure, that massive retaliation doctrine, it was based on the assumption that we would actually do it, right? That if the Russians were to launch a conventional war, that the president of the United States would be willing to then in turn murder 100 million Russians as a retaliation. It wasn't super far-fetched because we had done that in World War II, right? During the firebombing campaign in Japan, we burned the 80 largest cities in Japan to the ground, right? We flew over massive formations of B-29 bombers. They dropped incendiary bombs that weren't super accurate. You know, a lot of structures in World War II era Japan were made out of wood, wooden paper. And so that was our actual military strategy, was to burn Japan to the ground until they just couldn't take it anymore and surrendered. And we did a lot of the same thing in Germany. We burned Dresden to the ground. We burned multiple other cities to the ground. And so the idea in the 50s that we would do that again wasn't super far-fetched. But Eisenhower, he realized, hey, we're not going to do that, right? If the Russians launch a conventional war, we're not going to burn Russia to the ground with nuclear weapons. So during the 60s, Robert McNamara was the principal architect of something called flexible response. And that was that we would attempt through a wide range of different types of nuclear weapons and many of them to actually fight a nuclear war against Russia and win that war the way you always win wars, which is to deprive your enemy of the capacity to wage war against you. And if you can actually destroy the enemy's fielded forces, in this case nuclear forces, that the enemy would realize that he can't do anything to resist you and give up, right? And that's how we won World War II. So over time, we built this nuclear arsenal with many, many thousands of nuclear weapons in different modes, from bombers and missiles and subs, with increasing accuracy, and we targeted them against the Russian nuclear weapons. And the Russians did the same thing. They targeted their nuclear weapons against us, and they built a flexible response system to fight and win a nuclear war against the United States. And we tend to put our nuclear weapons in very isolated areas, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, etc. And so most of those weapons were pointed at those locations, but maybe a few other key command and control nodes like the Pentagon or Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado Springs, a few other places. And so there would certainly be a lot of damage if we were to fight that war, but most of it would be directed at these relatively less populated areas. And because in a flexible response, you know, nuclear war fighting posture, the thing that you're scared most about is your enemy attacking first and removing your capacity to retaliate, we maintained this system called launch on warning. So we had all these satellites and radars all over the world. So we maintained a launch on warning system. If we detected signs of a major Russian attack in progress, we would launch all of our intercontinental ballistic missiles, scramble our bombers, launch our submarine launch ballistic missiles, and get them out of the silos before they could be struck by the incoming Russian nuclear weapons. It takes about 30 minutes for an ICBM to go from Russia to the United States or vice versa. And so we maintained this very high levels of alerts, finely tuned to what was going on in Russia. We had command centers that were manned 24/7. We had command and control aircraft flying around the clock to transmit orders. And we had, you know, the famous football always in the possession of the president, so that at any moment, if we detected a launch, we could retaliate. Well, a number of things have happened since the end of the Cold War. The most important thing that has happened is that we have very drastically reduced the number of nuclear weapons in our possession and on alert. So through a series of what are called START treaties, Strategic Arms Reduction Treaties, beginning in 1991, we cut our nuclear weapons in half, and then we cut them in half again, and then we cut them in half a third time. So instead of having 30,000 nuclear weapons on alert today, we have the United States has about 1,400 weapons fielded, 450 missiles, and maybe a couple of submarines are on alert. Bombers no longer on alert. We have airborne command and control maintaining a lower level of readiness, not always airborne. And the Russians have about the same number, maybe a few hundred more on alert. And then our total arsenal is now about 7,000, most of which are in storage. So that hair trigger structure that we had in place, ready to fight the nuclear war at any given time, it just doesn't exist anymore, right? And right now, our strategy is based on the idea that because we're not at hair trigger alert, and the Russians aren't either, that if something really, really bad was going to happen, we would have some time. We would have days to weeks to sort of regenerate our alert posture, get those bombers on alert, get those command and control airplanes airborne, get more subs out to sea to prepare. And the Russians would sort of be doing the same thing, and we'd be watching each other as we did this preparation. And hopefully in that process, we would all get scared and cooler heads would prevail, as we say, and we would sort of back away from the nuclear precipice. And, you know, we would never get to the point where we'd actually launch the nuclear war.
It seems like as much as prepared as we used to be and how we are not anymore, and it sounds like the Russians are on the the same sort of level as that. Like they're not looking to start like another Cold War, or at least another arms race, or at least that seems to be the thing. But then in this tweet, one of Donald's tweets, I believe he said, you know, let it be an arms race. I think you already mentioned that we will outpass them, outdo them. But it sounds like we've moved a little beyond that. This might be posturing by one or even two leaders. But what about like people like leaders in the world, like Kim Jong-un, who is nuclear capable. And there seems to be a lot of talk. And again, I just get my information from the news. I don't have a very deep understanding of North Korea, the way North Korea works, but like people seem to be worried that he's a little bit of like a loose cannon. And now that seems to be, I don't live on the West Coast. I feel like that would be the place that would be in the biggest threat area. But again, you were saying that like Montana and Wyoming would probably be ahead of that because that's where the nuclear weapons are. But what, so how does it read into like, if someone like Donald Trump feels that he needs to flex his muscles a little bit and show off a little bit and talk tough a little bit, are there less responsible or aware leaders who have similar issues with, well, I need to flex and show. I need to show everyone that I'm not, for lack of a better term, going to get punked. Like, sure. I got to show them that they can't just do whatever they want. Like, I'm a force to be reckoned with.
In the military, we ultimately arrived at the conclusion that nuclear weapons are not useful for fighting and winning wars, mainly because of the risk of escalation. You can't use them to actually get what you want, right? About the only thing nuclear weapons are good for is the deterrence of the use of other nuclear weapons, right? We have a much bigger investment in conventional capability, and that's what we use to do that.
And we've been to war many times since,
as a matter of fact,
the invention of nuclear war, and we haven't used them.
That's right. There have been some very big wars. In fact, wars that we were worried could actually lead to nuclear escalation. Korea was one of them. You know, we intervened on the Korean Peninsula with the assumption that the Chinese wouldn't get involved because of the risk of escalation. It wasn't until we sort of recaptured the peninsula and were on our way to driving out, you know, the communist regime of the North, that the Chinese intervened and started sending troops south of the Yalu River and forcing a stalemate. Then there was a time when Douglas MacArthur was seriously thinking about and actually requesting the authority to use tactical nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula because he didn't have the conventional forces to drive back the Chinese, right? And MacArthur rather famously not only denied the request, but fired him because he just didn't want that kind of commander in charge of this conflict, right? There were other times, certainly when the Russians became directly involved in the Vietnam War. There were times when we thought the Russians would become directly involved in other regional conflicts like the Six-Day War between Israel and her Arab neighbors. There were when the Russians invaded Poland, right? There were times when we really thought this thing could get out of hand. Cooler heads prevailed. It took some time for us to ratchet that up. There was this thing, especially shortly after the Cuban Missile Crisis, called brinksmanship. And the idea was that, well, maybe you could deliberately escalate the conflict right up to the point where you're ready to fight the nuclear war, to demonstrate that you're serious and get your enemies to back down, right? And Khrushchev genuinely feared a nuclear attack from the United States and a kickoff of World War III during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that's one of the reasons why he decided to back down and remove the missiles from Cuba, right? So, yeah, we've come close on a number of occasions, but we never crossed over that line. And, you know, we're now in far less capable position to escalate things to the brink of nuclear war because we just don't have that state of readiness. We don't have the nuclear weapons in place. The Minuteman missiles that are in the silos in North Dakota are 60 years old in some cases, and they're super expensive. So when Donald Trump talks about, hey, I'm going to greatly expand our nuclear capability, the good news is that's going to be really hard for him to do. And any project that he launches will not come to fruition until long after he's left office.
When I hear stuff like that, when I hear him saying, like, oh, let's expand nuclear capabilities, like, I don't really understand how nuclear weapons work, how building them works anyway, and things like that. In my brain, that can be done in a year or two. But what you're saying is that, like, to expand the U.S. nuclear arsenal would take longer than, I assume you're guessing, for worst case scenario, you're guessing that he's in for two terms. You're saying that would take longer than two terms, like 8 years, or longer than one term, 4 years?
It would take longer than 8 years. Right now, the U.S. Air Force, you know, because those Minuteman missiles are so old, we are losing confidence that they'll actually work. We still want to have them available as a deterrent capability, you know, and until we get to zero nuclear weapons, we're going to need that deterrence. But because those weapons are so old, we are not 100% sure that if we try to launch them, they would work, right? And the essence of deterrence is credibility. So the U.S. Air Force is investigating a replacement of those missiles. They have budgeted $20 billion over the next 5 years to study the problem and determine the requirements and actually design the program. Once they're ready to actually start building new missiles, it's going to take 10 years and $100 billion to replace the 450 Minuteman IIIs that we currently have fielded. And of course, the way these programs work, they always are more expensive than you expect, and they always take longer. And so maybe the Air Force won't get 450, maybe they'll get 300, maybe they'll get 200, and it'll take a long time, 10, 12, 15 years, for them to actually install those new missiles, right? So Donald Trump can you know, he can talk, he can make himself feel better by saying we're going to do these things, but it's just not how it works.
So it sounds like in a best case scenario, if on January 21st, Donald Trump was like, you know, build me a nuclear arsenal.
Yeah.
The soonest he would even see that is like 2030, 2031, like in a best case scenario.
Right. Best case scenario. And he'll be long gone. And that assumes that Congress gives him everything that he asked for.
Okay. That's a little bit more comforting. I mean, there's still a lot of things that I think weigh, you know, heavily on my mind and heavily on a lot of other people's minds when it comes to, I think the bravado and the sort of like strongman sort of qualities that Donald Trump kind of puts out there. You know, you get nervous because it's the first time we've had a president who tweets all mm-hmm. these things. And so you're like, oh, like, how does that affect world affairs? You know, maybe it affects greatly. Maybe it doesn't. Although I get the impression that eventually it'll come to pass. And that's probably something we can talk about another day, is like the effects of sort of like negotiation in the age of Twitter, when you have somebody who seems to be a little bit addicted to his phone, you know, running the United States military. But one of the things that I want to sort of like transition into is, so you're saying basically that it sounds like my concern, at least to, which is a legitimate concern, I still think about it some days, but my concern to be like, well, I need to be at least ready to bail, because like, boy, that would be a shame if there was a bomb dropped like right on Constitution Hall, which is not far from my house. But it sounds like that's not going to be the case for a number of reasons. But the biggest one is that there's time in these global affairs, especially because we're not, like you were saying, we're not quite as ready as we used to be. So it wouldn't be like we could just like unload an entire single attack in a matter of like, I got mad at 6 p.m. The negotiations were 12 hours long, and then we're like, time to do it. It sounds like that's not the issue, is what you're saying, is that it's not going to be something that quick.
It would be very, very tough to do. And it actually takes three people to launch nuclear weapons. There's a thing called what we call the National Command Authorities. And that's composed of the President, Secretary of Defense, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they all pretty much have to agree to do this thing. The president is the one that sort of initiates it, and he has a role to play. And if there was if we suddenly decided that we were under attack by the Russians and they were going to launch some ICBMs at us, we wanted to retaliate and we didn't have much time to do it. The military officer that always follows around the president with the football, which has the nuclear codes in it, would sit him down somewhere, open up that football, and then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or whoever is available, would start talking the president through the number of response options. But then it takes the president, the SecDef, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, to transmit those orders to the forces and execute the war plan, right? And so I think, you know, unless we were surprised and really convinced that this thing was happening, they would be trying to look for ways out of the escalation, short of starting the nuclear war.
Okay, so there's two other people involved here.
Absolutely.
That I didn't know. I mean, I guess maybe I learned it at one point. But so you're telling me that, like, so it's not just... Okay, so that actually makes me feel a lot better. There's two other people who it sounds like are at least seasoned military professionals,
yeah,
who also sit down and jump into this thing. It's not just the president being like, all right, shoot him off.
Launch him, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not how it works. We should all take some comfort in the appointment of General Mattis in that regard. General Mattis is, of course, a career Marine officer. He knows what it's like to fight wars. He's had men and women die under his command. He's super aware of what it means to actually use those kind of capabilities. I think in that particular scenario, he would be the voice of reason. Apparently he loves these generals, right? So he takes what they have to say seriously.
Well, that's good to know.
The potential for the Russians to launch some significant number of nuclear weapons without any notice at all would be very tough for them to do. They, in particular, have had a real challenge maintaining their nuclear command and control system because, just like nuclear weapons, the command and control systems are super expensive. And if you want to maintain... You know, if you want to actually transmit force orders to your forces so that they can launch weapons, and those forces are located in Siberia, you have to have some kind of network in place to get those orders to them, and that's hard to maintain. Right now, we just don't think the Russians have that capability. They could probably get there if they were serious about it. It would take them some time.
How much of this, especially on, say, the part of, like, someone like Vladimir Putin, who I think didn't he put out, wasn't the whole reason that Trump put that tweet out about let's expand the nuclear capabilities is that Vladimir Putin said something else that was a little chest thumpy too, like, we're going to build up. But how much of this do you think is just chest thumping? I mean, I've heard a number of things about him in the past. Wasn't a big part of the fall of the Soviet Union that, at least in the later years, that it was kind of all a show? Not all a show, but like they were not as, we discovered after the fact that they weren't quite as poised and dangerous as we thought. They were still dangerous, but there was a lot of like puffing up and making themselves look bigger. And is that something that we're looking at now? Is like somebody like Vladimir Putin being like, look at how tough I am. And this is really just a strategy to sort of like protect his national interests, especially like his recent annexation of Crimea and stuff like that. Like he doesn't want people coming in and telling him what to do. So he's going to make it look like he's more dangerous than he actually is.
One of the really amazing things about the end of the Cold War is that war didn't break out between the Soviet Union and somebody, and probably us, because that tends to be what happens when countries fall apart. We have this attitude, this sort of impression, especially in America, that Kim Jong-il or Saddam Hussein or Gorbachev in the 80s, if they're going to launch a war, it's because they have made some calculation about what they are going to gain. And that, you know, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, that he calculated that, oh, I'm going to get all this oil and it's going to make my country better and I have more to gain than to lose by taking this gamble, and that's why I'm doing it, right? But that's the history of warfare shows that that's not why wars get started. Wars, more often than not, tend to get started because of internal politics. If we worry about somebody like Kim Jong-un, he's using, when he's rattling his saber, he is not talking to us. He's talking to his own people. He's worried about losing power. So he trumps up this idea, no pun intended, of a great American threat and makes his people super scared of that boogeyman. And then says, I am your only protection against this, and so we have to mobilize the economy to serve my military agenda. Most of the time, when Kim Jong-un is making threats on TV, the audience is not us. The audience is his own people, and he's trying to consolidate his own power.
What you're saying is these wars start because of... not because they're like, like you were saying, like, I've got this plan. And it's like, it's not like an international heist.
Right. The Americans have something I want. If I attack them, I can get that thing. That's not it. And one of the amazing things that happened when we started these series of arms reduction treaties in the early 90s is we incorporated on-site inspections, right? We say, hey, we're going to cut our nuclear weapons and we're going to verify it by actually going to Russia, and we're going to let the Russians come over here and inspect our nuclear facilities and our nuclear bases, and they can actually count the warheads. This is one of the things I did when I was a lieutenant. In 1996, I was a START treaty escort officer, so I escorted the Russians around F.E. Warren Air Force Base, and we actually took them into our nuclear weapons storage facility. And they got to count the warheads, right? And they could sort of verify that we had the number of warheads that we were allowed to have per the treaty. And we went there and did the same thing. One of the things that we discovered was that you're right. They were not nearly as ready to fight the nuclear war as we thought, mainly because it's super hard and super expensive to maintain a vast nuclear enterprise in a constant state of war fighting readiness, right? Those missiles are complicated. They require a lot of maintenance. If you're going to have them sitting there so that they're ready to launch all the time, then they require a lot of attention, and that's really hard and expensive. And they didn't do it for most of their fielded forces, right? They had some portion that they kept sort of at a higher rate of readiness, but they weren't, it wasn't the whole thing like we thought, right? And that's even more the case now. So when Vladimir Putin, I think the statement you were referring to is his end of year briefing that he does, his end of year national security review that he does on TV.
Yes, that's the one.
He talked about how that Russia would build a capacity to penetrate any ballistic missile defenses that were developed. And so he's specifically talking about the anti-ballistic missile, the ABM system, that we'd have deployed in Eastern Europe and in Alaska to intercept incoming nuclear warheads. This is a thing that we built in the Bush years, and we sort of justified it as being able to intercept either North Korea or or Iranian nuclear weapons. If they're coming into the U.S. or to Western Europe, we'd be able to shoot them down, right? Very hard to shoot down nuclear weapons. There's no guarantee that any such system would work. And it sort of erodes the idea of mutually assured destruction, the foundation of deterrence, right? That if you can shoot down your adversary's nuclear weapons, then you don't have to be afraid of his deterrence, his retaliatory capability. And so you can go ahead and start the nuclear war. Of course, the ABM system that we have isn't anywhere near the size that would need to be to neutralize the Russian arsenal. That's not really what it's designed to do. It's not pointed at Russia. But because Vladimir Putin has to sort of preserve the confidence in his nuclear arsenal, you know, for his own power base, every year he says, oh, don't worry about that thing because we can overcome it, right? And it's one of those things in international relations that happens that's part of this ongoing international dialogue that if you heard it out of context, you might be concerned about it. But it's really not too much to be concerned about. It's one of the things that allows world leaders to save face so that they don't feel like they have to actually back up those words, right? Just like the president not calling the president of Taiwan, right? It doesn't mean anything, but it's one of the things that we do to let the Chinese save face so that if they don't invade Taiwan. And Donald Trump, being a guy who doesn't know about these things because he just has no experience in it, he's just hearing these things out of context. He doesn't know, and he overreacts.
And I'm wondering, too, if you were saying a little bit, especially about Kim Jong-un, that, you know, when he's rattling his saber, and it sounds like a little bit with Vladimir Putin when he's rattling his saber, some of it is, like you said, for their own power base, a little bit for their own, like, look, people of my country, there's this external threat way over there, and we're going to go get them. Or not we're going to get them, but you need me to protect you from them. They may be coming over here.
That's absolutely right. Kim Jong-un does it. The religious leadership of Iran does it, right? Whenever they're saying death to America, they're not talking to us. You know, in America, we tend to view these things in terms of we tend to take an egocentric approach to these things. But that's why we have diplomats, right? So, yeah, don't get too worried about those kind of statements.
I'm wondering if, in reverse, if maybe some of these statements and tweets from Donald Trump are a similar thing. I mean, his whole campaign was run on, like, watch out. There's so many dangerous things in the world. Coming over here, I'm the only one who can save you. And it makes me wonder if some of even this nuclear rattling is just a way for him to be like, you need me. You know, I think there's a lot of talk. He does a lot of talking about how it was a landslide victory, and election results show that that's not true. And that he talks a lot about, I don't think I've heard him say it, but his members of the team have talked about having a mandate, and everyone knows that he's on very shaky ground. You know, he lost the popular vote. So it makes me wonder sometimes if maybe some of these things also, if the purpose isn't just to be like, the world is dangerous, let's not look at these other things that might reveal my political weaknesses. Let's look at nuclear arms race. Like, we need a nuclear arms race. And then that changes the conversation, and people are like, well, no, we don't need that. And suddenly we're discussing whether or not we need his help. And there's plenty of people in this country who might actually not be supporters, but be scared enough to be like, well, he's the president now, and oh, I'm really nervous, but I guess I need him, because if this is what he's going to do. Does that make any sense? That got a little bit, that fell apart at the end. But what I mean is that, like, is that a viable strategy to scare people who are on the fence about him to be like, come on over?
I think you've put your finger right on it, right? And we are going to have to get used to, we should not get used to, but we are going to have to sort of retune our ear to the way the president talks. Donald Trump was elected by his base on just that premise that, you know, hey guys, the world is super dangerous. There's all these terrible people out there. There's ISIS, there's Mexicans, and they're all coming to get you. And I'm the only thing that's going to be between them and you, and I will protect you. And this guy Obama, and this person Hillary, they don't get it. They're not out there to protect you. They're actually in league with these guys. But make no mistake, they're coming for you, and I'm going to protect you, right? And so, absolutely, right? Whether consciously or not, Donald Trump, when he says, I'm going to build our nuclear arsenal, he may not even have a serious plan to do so, right? But the communication is the important thing.
On that, like, especially when you say that we need to, refine our sort of like, it's like retune how we listen to the president, sort of like re-evaluate like the way we take in the messages that he puts out. We were talking the other day about institutions and about how, because one of the things is if he's look out for these people, and you know, you need me and you need this, there's a concern based on just the way that he ran his campaign and the way that his base kind of reacts to strongman leadership and authoritarianism, that there also could be an erosion of civil liberties over the next like 4 to 8 years, especially because of the fact that, I mean, he's talked very nakedly about wanting to roll back certain things, or he's talked very clearly like his attitude has inspired a lot of people to be like, yeah, I'm mad and maybe I'll punch this guy who's walking out of this rally. And like, we saw a spike in hate crimes after he was elected. So one of the things that on the nuclear front, on the home front, on my daily life front, is that we have to look at, you were saying, like the institutions, like that's, yeah, the society has, civilization has not failed in 13,000 years. And a big part of that is the fact that they're in different cultures and in different countries along the way. There are all these civic institutions, some good, some bad, somewhere in between. But obviously we have a bunch of them here in America. And, a lot of newspapers were saying, I shouldn't say a lot, but I read a few articles that were like, institutions won't save you. And I have to say that was really disconcerting. I was like, that I don't know what to do. Like, you know, but you were saying, we were talking the other day, that we really need to sort of strengthen our civic institutions. Like, the institutions really at the end of the day are only as strong as its membership, is only strong as like the involvement of people like you and me. So what's that about? I subscribed to the New York Times right after the election, because everyone said that, like, you know, newspapers need subscribers because newspapers are the ones that do like this journalistic work to investigate things like when the president is out of line or when civil rights are being rolled back in places like North Carolina. And also then people were like, oh, and you also have to donate to like the ACLU, which I also did. But at the end of the day, also, there's like a part of me that's like, it feels, the ACLU felt good because I'm like, well, you know, you always need money to like litigate cases and to fight cases in court. But the bigger one is, you know, what can I do on a more local level? I think the reason for that is because besides just the fact that I'm worried about legislation, I'm worried about the increase in police and military for the express purpose of scaring up potential wars in other countries, or arresting people because, like, you know, that's what we do, law and order, we're going to put people in jail. The thing is there seems to be a groundswell of support for this. So how do I help reverse that groundswell? Meaning, like, I'm all for law and order, I'm all for like police and the criminal justice system, but I also think that like it can be a hammer, and sometimes what we need is not a hammer. Sometimes we need a little more understanding of communities and figuring out how to talk to people who are different than us. I live in an African American neighborhood. I'm one of like only a handful of white people. And I've seen firsthand like how policing is very different in the neighborhood I live in now than the one I grew up in suburban Omaha, Nebraska. So the issue here is like, how do you and I assist, strengthen these pillars? Does that make sense?
Sure. That is a great question. I think it's really important to understand, you know, how does your government actually do the things or not do the things that you're afraid of or that you want to happen and are not happening? Because there have been periods in American history where there have been some periods of some pockets of great instability, even a breakdown of the social order. Katrina, very briefly on 9/11 in downtown New York. A few places, right? Of course, we had a civil war.
There was that, yeah. There was
right? That. We had a Great Depression. And sure, civilization reasserted itself. And we recovered from those things. But there was some period of time, days to weeks to months, where things were really, really bad at very specific locations. You know, if you were in the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans when Katrina hit, your neighborhood was destroyed. And it took a long, and they still haven't recovered. But when that happens, it's not because of that external threat. For Katrina, for example, the levees didn't break because they weren't designed well, or because we don't know how to not have neighborhoods destroyed by hurricanes. The levees failed because of neglect, right? Because of 30 years of neglect, where we sort of decided as a society that, you know, we don't care as much about those people. And so we're just not going to invest the resources into making sure that those folks are going to be protected when a really, really bad natural disaster strikes them. And that neglect was because of a lack of, you know, because we let our civilian leaders engage in that process of neglect. I think one of the things that we could really got to resist the temptation is to focus on all these big national issues, and we're all devastated about Trump. But at the same time, you know, we lost more ground in state houses, mm-hmm. we lost more ground in governorships, we lost more ground at the local level where these things are actually done. Right? Somebody has to decide how much money the police department gets and how much money the fire department gets and what kind of preparations they're going to make so that when the hurricane hits or terrorist attack hits or whatever it is, they'll be prepared, right? And when that happens, how are they going to respond and who are they going to take care of and what are their priorities going to be and who are they going to work with and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And all of those things are paid for with local taxes and determined by local leadership who are often elected by local votes, right? And I really think that's where we need to be focusing on mm-hmm. to make sure that our government is structured the way we want it to be.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And that's something that I think I've talked a lot about in my personal life. Mm-hmm. The issue that I run into from time to time is that a lot of the people that I speak with, and you might not suffer from the same problem with the political views you have and coming from a career in the military. But with me, a lot of the people I talk to, they already agree with, they're like, of course. Yeah, we need more money for this. And we need to make sure that like tax rates will support the, like you were saying, the fire department, the police department. We have to make sure we have budgets that work. And that might mean higher taxes in some ways and things like that. There's just different points of view on that. But I only have a handful of people, and they're out there, but I have a handful of people in my circle who don't believe that. But the problem is I don't have, I don't have a lot of people that I get to talk to that like maybe we can talk about our differences and figure it out, because a lot of my friends and I actually have relatively similar views. But the other one is that the people that I do have in my circle that are a little bit different, sometimes we avoid talking about that. I mean, sometimes it's, I have a few Facebook friends, like people I knew from high school and early college. I have a few people in my life who I see on a semi-regular basis who have views where they would be like, well, we need to save money. We need to tax less. Therefore, yeah, we don't fix the levies this year. And then, you know, next year comes around and, well, we don't fix them this year. You know, taxes, like we need to lower taxes.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't get into those conversations as often, sometimes because we don't want it to get uncomfortable. Sometimes because when we do, it especially if it's online, it escalates so quickly into two things. Either I've moved on, I don't do personal attacks anymore. There was a time on my online living where when I would get into a fight, it would eventually devolve into, and you've got a weird looking face, yeah, and you're fat. the reason your job sucks is because you're not smart. Sure. It's stuff like that. So that's not really a thing I have to worry about anymore. I don't really engage in that. I do have one or two people on my feed who do engage in that, but they usually get cut off pretty quick. But the bigger one is that you get into, I call them fact fights,
sure,
where like you're not really talking to each other. You're just dropping facts. And the thing is sometimes they're cherry picked. Sometimes they're very skewed, just opinion wise. You know, they're like, well, if you look at this and this and this, and it's not in context.
Yeah.
But no one's really listening, because every time you post and every time they post, you're like, this fact is gonna end it, but you're not really having a conversation. So, you know, local is clearly the way to go. Like you're saying, like we need to, because that's where all the day-to-day decisions are made, you know, whether or not my streets are well taken care of. And I have to say, I might be one of the few people to say this, but City of Philadelphia, you're doing a great job, because they just fixed a bunch of stuff in my neighborhoods. I'm psyched. But like that stuff, like you said, gets made on the local level, and right, the people I talk to, you know, where do we get into that? You know, where do I find people of differing points of view that we can at least come to some sort of consensus? Because that's the other thing, was we have to move things forward, yeah, right? We can't just like sit in our own like corners and like throw angry facts at each other.
Yeah. You know, I think I have kind of a unique perspective on this, because I am a bull moose progressive, but I spent 22 years in the military. There are a few square pegs in the military who have sort of a different view on things, but to a large extent, the stereotype is pretty close to accurate in that most of the people in the military, especially career officers, career NCOs, tend to have a pretty conservative outlook with a big emphasis on personal responsibility. And so if you're going to be a bull moose progressive in a conservative military for 22 years, you have to, you know, if you're going to actually do your job, you have to listen to people and you have to not take things personally. You have to have a thick skin and you have to find, you know, some common ground to actually do the things you need to do. And one of the amazing things about the U.S. military, because we are a civilian-led organization, we have this professional ethos. And that no matter who the civilians are who are in charge of the military, Democrat or Republican, this was the case when Bill Clinton was, you know, when I came into the military, Bill Clinton was president. It was the case when George W. Bush came in, and it was the case under Obama, in that we are focused on the mission regardless of the political motives of or our viewpoint of the political motives of the civilian leaders, right? And whenever we had something to do, we focused on that mission, right? We focused on achieving the tactical effect that we are trying to achieve, where politics just don't enter into it, right? Your ideology is not going to be of any help in getting a bomb onto a target or getting an airplane safely back on the ground after it's had some sort of malfunction, right? Or any number of the material problems that we face every day. So I think that approach could be applied to local politics, right? We have to find things that we all want done, whether that be some sort of public works project, better streets, etc., whatever it happens to be, and find some way to talk to each other about those things that focuses on the accomplishing of those goals, and not whether or not we think we are good people. And the more local you are, the easier that is to do, because you and your neighbor share the same electrical grid, right? And you and your neighbor share the same garbage removal system or whatever the case is. And it's much easier to talk about what works and what doesn't work at that level than it is about these big national issues that we tend to focus on.
That makes a lot of sense. Actually, I had never thought about that before, because my dad was a sergeant major in the Army Reserves. He has a very pragmatic outlook on most things. And that never occurred to me until just now, the idea that, like, you're right. Like, I've had to work with a number of different people on a number of different things in my day, either theatrically or, you know, I've had a number of day jobs where you go in and it's interesting though, because like, you know, you always have one or two people who are like, this is how things need to be done. We do them like this because of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always work like that. You know, depending on the situation. And one of the things that was always really good, with a lot of the crews that I worked with, both on tours and on, I did some catering gigs. Like that was a big one because you were like setting up huge spaces and then tearing them down and, you know, not super consequential things, but like things where like this has to be done and it has to be done by this time. Cause this is when people show up for either the performance or for their wedding.
Yeah.
And you have to get it set up by a certain time or you have to do this by a certain time. And most people were all about getting it done. There was sometimes some squabbling if things didn't go right. Like, well, if we'd only done this, but generally that was usually didn't turn into a big, big thing. I've had one or two jobs where that is a thing where you have an ideologue who's like, well, if only we'd been doing this or this or that, or this or this or that. The irony, or maybe not the irony, but the interesting part about that is those people usually got fired, like not right away, but like over time if they were held a grudge. So maybe that, you know, maybe there is something about that. Like I do have a lot of neighbors who I'm sure I don't agree with.
Yeah. If you take an ideological approach mm-hmm. to solving physical problems in the world and it doesn't work, it's pretty easy to discredit that approach.
So it sounds like just, yeah, local, which a lot of people say. I've heard that before, and I think I've even probably spouted it from time to time, but I think that it's easier said than done, or people like to say it, but then don't do anything.
Yeah. It's hard. It's hard to go out and talk to people.
Boy, that is the truth. That is the truth. And there's some things we didn't get to, but that's fine because we're going to be doing this for a while. So I'll just write them down and we'll hit.
Yeah.
But one of the things maybe we need to talk about is on the local level and what you're saying, talking to people is hard. What's something that each of us can do before we get back together again? Like, so we're big on taking action. We're talking about taking action. We're talking about how to keep activism and things like that alive in the age of Trump right now. And part of it is we're saying being local and talking to people. Yeah. So what's one thing each of us can do? And we'll check back in next time to see if we did it and how we can kind of measure that success. Cause obviously I don't think it'll be an immediate thing, but let's start with what's one thing each of us can do.
That's a great question. And I think it's going to be different for everybody. So for me, you know, I just retired from the military. My wife and I just moved to the Fort Worth area. So we don't know this area very well. We've never lived here. So for me, I'm going to focus on not just getting to know the area, but on learning what the issues are here that people are concerned about. And I'm going to do that. So I just signed up for a meetup.org account. I'm looking around for different groups that meet. And I've also subscribed to the Tarrant County Democrats newsletter. And they have a calendar that they post every month about here's all the different things that you could participate in, volunteer for, just get to meet people and talk about issues, etc. So over the next week, I'm going to find a meeting to go to and go talk to people about and learn about what they care about here. And get to know this area a little bit, because I think we're going to be here for a long time. That's what I'm going to do.
I think what I'm going to do. So I have an uncle, and I got to say, like I've gone back and forth on this. We talked about this a little while ago. I've been like, I'm going to go talk to this uncle. This is like I've got like we've all got one or two uncles or dads or moms who differ from us politically. And this uncle was absolutely a Trump voter. He voted for Trump. He was really excited about Trump, which is interesting because he's a very religious fellow and Trump flies in the face of everything he's ever taught. This particular uncle, it's a long story, but we've all got this relative, right? We've all got one or two of these guys who are in our lives. And, you know, Steve, my uncle, is a really good guy, but I don't understand some of the things that he believes in. He's always been very nice to me, but he's got very anti-immigrant views. He's got very anti-LGBT views. He's very anti-choice. Mm. Like he and I could not be more different. However, there is one thing that we agree on, which is he is a very staunch supporter of the idea behind Black Lives Matter. Now the reason I said the idea behind it is if I said like, Steve, you're into Black Lives Matter, he actually might say like, no, I think that some of those guys go way too far. And that's because he's a Fox News watcher and they've probably said like, well, you know, Black Lives Matter folks shoot cops.
Yeah.
And he probably buys it. But the interesting thing is he's talked to me more than once though about how we need to get a handle on police brutality and that he's talked about how the criminal justice system has an inherent racial bias. Now this blows my mind that he harbors all these other ideas that I very much disagree with. But then he did say to me, it was a while ago, it was like a year ago, he was like, we really need to talk and maybe find out like what we can do on this. And I don't really know where this conversation is going to go. And the reason I say this is because this uncle, really good, has always been very loving to me, but sure. has these views that could be very hateful at times. He also, I'm not sure where it can go, because he sometimes likes to transition from the thing you agree on to then be like, now let's talk about this other thing. And let me try to convince you that all your gay friends need to not be gay anymore. So like, I'm entering like a little bit of a weird place, because I want to talk to him about this and maybe talk to how we can like bring people together who don't see eye to eye politically on everything, but this is the one thing we do see eye to eye on. You know, maybe that inspires conversation and maybe that gets all of us kind of out of our bubble a little bit,
yeah.
But it's also a little bit, it makes me a little bit nervous, because he's got a track record of being like, now that we've talked about that, let me try to pull you into this other issue that you're not interested in changing your mind about. But who knows? I mean, maybe I'm doing that with him by being like, maybe if I start with Black Lives Matter, I can get him to change his mind on this. So who knows?
Yeah.
I think that for me right now, talking to people who aren't the same as me is at the very least helpful. It's a, you know, even if I walk away mad, maybe it would help if I understand certain outlooks, and maybe it'll just help me talk to them about the things that we disagree on in a more eloquent way.
Right. Yeah. You know, the only way we're going to turn this thing around is to change the way we do politics, right? You know, right now our political system favors a rural minority. Donald Trump won because of an electoral college that favors a rural minority. Favors small states. Congress maintains a permanent Republican majority because of gerrymandering favors a rural minority. And those congressional districts are drawn by your state legislatures. And in 2020, when we have a new census, those legislatures, those congressional districts are going to be redrawn. And that is our opportunity to balance things out a little bit more. The only way we're going to do that is to get the people who live next door to us to vote for different candidates, and they're only going to do that if they think they have a good reason to do that, right? So we're going to have to talk to them and get them thinking about these issues in a different way.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, that's a good place to, I think that's a good place to finish, and we can talk a little bit about how that went next time. Like, you know, Matt, it's been a pleasure. It's really good to talk to you about this stuff, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about a lot more of this stuff. Like I said, I've got a whole list we didn't even get to. Just from what we talked about today, there's some other things that are bouncing around in my brain too.
Sure.
To anybody listening out there, I'd like to remind you, so go to iTunes and rate us. That really helps to raise our visibility, and it brings other people to hear the podcast as well. So go find us. It's over there. And you can find us at iTunes. And you can also, Matt, what's your Twitter handle? They can find you on Twitter, yeah?
You can find me on Twitter at Martin3116.
You can find me on Twitter at Terrence Brennan. That's T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E, Brennan, B-R-E-N-N-A-N. So, excellent. Well, thank you guys very much for listening. And I guess we'll talk to everybody next week.
I'll see you over there, Terry.
I'll see you over there.
So prepare, say a prayer. Send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over. And we won't come back till it's over.